If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm your host, Ed Newcomer, and I want to welcome you to the show. We're in season two now, and one of the things that I keep being told I should do is figure out ways to engage with my listeners and my watchers. So I'm trying. I'm doing my best, trying to make the podcast grow. So I'll tell you what we'll do. Anybody who's watching this podcast knows that I'm working on a mustache. So if you like the mustache, go on to YouTube, go on to our social media pages, and just make a comment. Mustache equals yes or mustache equals no. And just like the fabulous Mr. Fox, I appreciate your advice and I value your input, but I'll probably ignore it. All right. Our guest this week is George Wilson, a former officer and lieutenant with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Get this, he's got a 36-year career with Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, which is amazing. Ended his career as a lieutenant and made his way up to overseeing the statewide investigative unit for the state of Florida. That basically put him with oversight of their surveillance unit, their internet crimes unit, their computer forensics unit, and their covert operations unit. Really impressive guy. I had opportunities to work with George during my own career and was always impressed. We always got along well, and we actually accomplished a hell of a lot of good things together. And so George is going to be back on the show because we got a lot of stuff we want to talk to George about. But George Wilson, thanks so much for being on the show.
Hey, Ed, thanks for inviting me. We're going to have some more good times. And I got to say, the mustache, it's a keeper. It makes you look younger.
Wow, younger. Despite the fact that when we were first getting warmed up today, the first thing you said to me was, "What's with all the gray?" All right. Well, we'll put George down that George is a mustache equals yes. All right. Good. Appreciate your input, George. Hey, you and I both ended up kind of retiring around the same time. I think within maybe a year or two of each other. But since your retirement with the with Florida, you have stayed in the mix. You've still been involved in, you know, helping to deal with wildlife crime issues, pretty serious wildlife crime issues. Do you want to kind of explain what you've been doing since and who you've been working for? And then we'll jump in on a really interesting topic that is very topical and in the news right now. But yeah, tell us what you've been doing since you retired.
Yeah, Ed, I mean, it's hard to get it out of your system. You know, you work for so many years. But after I retired, I connected with a group of individuals that are all retired fish and wildlife officers. They're former chiefs, former commanders of some of the largest conservation agencies in the United States. And so they have a company where we do law enforcement consulting in emerging countries, and we try to build the capacity of conservation programs in developing countries, developing nations. But it's a good group of guys. I mean, these guys, like I said, are former chiefs and commanders. You know, Bob Farrell, Mike Cenci, Greg Cassad, Curtis Brown. I mean, these are the guys that developed the most advanced, you know, law enforcement programs in the United States. So like me, you know, they want to stay, you know, committed to the cause and just kind of spreading our knowledge around the world.
That's awesome. Yeah. Some of the names you mentioned there, you know, I recognize Curtis, I think, was chief of Florida
yes.
Fish and Wildlife Commission. Right. And that's a big agency. The agency you worked for is one of the bigger state wildlife law enforcement agencies, I think, in the country. How many sworn officers? Like 800, 850, something like that?
Yeah, it's up to around 900 officers now.
That's incredible. You know, most states are lucky if they have like 200 or 250 mm-hmm. officers for the state. California, I think, has about 250-ish sworn officers, and it's probably landmass bigger than Florida. So, That's pretty amazing. Also, you mentioned Mike Sensei, who was the deputy chief in Washington, and I think very highly of the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Police, for sure. And then some of the other names you mentioned, what states were they from? Do you remember?
You know, Bob Farrell was the chief there in California for a while. Then he went over to Hawaii and was a chief over in Hawaii.
Right. That's awesome. Yeah, very cool. And when you do your work, are you like, are you working through NGOs or how does it work?
Yeah, we contract with various NGOs. If you think about the NGOs we worked with in the United States, you know, the Wild Turkey Federation, Ducks Unlimited, you know, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Well, there's also international NGOs and nonprofits that are working to build the capacity of other nations. You know, you've got Wild Aid, which is based out of California, the Nature Conservancy, you know, based out of Virginia. You know, you got Global Fishing Watch, the Wildlife Justice Commission. I mean, there's quite a few international organizations.
Yeah.
And so we consult with various organizations to try to build these emerging countries.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that we're not going to talk about today, you and I, but on another time when you're going to be on in the future, we're going to talk about something you and I did together along with a wildlife officer here in California named Gary Van Atta, Operation Wild Web, which targeted illegal sales on the internet. And one of the key aspects of that was working very closely with NGOs. Which is kind of unusual for law enforcement to work so closely with NGOs, but it can be incredibly productive when you do it right.
Very.
Yeah. And what we're going to talk about today is a perfect example of that. And what I love about this is when I called you, I had seen this story in the news. So what we're talking about today is very timely. It's not like we're talking about an old case. We're going to talk about something that's kind of like unfolding this year and last year. And that's Operation Red Dawn 1 and Red Dawn 2, which is something you were involved in. And, you know, it's been in the news. And when I saw it in the news, you and I think, just happened to be talking. And I realized you were involved in it. And I was like, oh, my gosh, George, you got to be on the show. We got to talk about this. So tell us a little bit about what is Operation Red Dawn 1 and 2 and How did you get involved in it?
Yeah, both operations, Red Dawn 1 and 2, were operations conducted in the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
And so looking at the Bahamas, it's a Caribbean nation. You know, it's 50 miles off the coast of Florida, but a very, very pristine nation with lots of natural resources. And so that's one of the programs where we're working with Wild Aid, is in the Bahamas. And so Wild Aid is partnered with the Nature Conservancy to create a marine action partnership to build the capacity of the Bahamas. And the Bahamas is very unique, but think about it, because you have a lot of citizens from the United States that are traveling over to the Bahamas by vessel. And, you know, as we know, some of these are going to abuse the natural resources. And if you think about the Bahamas, let's look at the Bahamas. So it's over 2,000 islands.
Mm.
It's over 2 million square miles of patrol area. So think about, you know, your responsibility of patrolling an area like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bahamas, it's different. It's not the United States. And as our favorite sheriff here in Polk County would say, people must have grits for brains if they think they're going to go to the Bahamas and violate the law. Because the Bahamas doesn't have a Fourth Amendment.
Right.
It doesn't have a Fifth Amendment. Doesn't have any Bill of Rights.
Right.
So you're going to go to the Bahamas and violate the law? You must have grits for brains.
Yeah. Good chance you're going to get arrested, right?
Right. And what I love about the Bahamas, you realize there's no statute of limitations on fisheries charges?
Wow. No statute of limitations. So just so listeners understand what a statute of limitation is, basically in most laws, there's a time in which law enforcement has to bring a case to charges. So it might be kind of typical statute of limitations might be 2 years. In the federal realm, it's usually 5 years. So what that means is the government has 5 years or 2 years, whatever the statute of limitation is, to bring charges against an individual. And if the bad guy can get away with it long enough and push that statute of limitations, they actually can't be charged. So like certain crimes like murder in the United States have no statute of limitations, but most crimes do have something. But yeah, so Bahamas has no statute of limitations. So it might be 5-10 years down the road. If they develop a case against you, they could charge you, huh?
So think about that picture you posted on Facebook 10 years ago.
Yeah, true. Of you committing some crime down in Bahamas, fishing violation in the Bahamas. Could so come back to haunt you.
The Bahamas is very, very protective of their natural resources. And I got to tell you, some of the people that we're working with there are the most dedicated officers I've ever seen, you know, throughout the world. And, you know, we develop a close relationship with them. And so we kind of provide nicknames to some of the people that we work with. You know, some of the nicknames we gave to you, Ed, back when you were working.
which were all good, George. All of my nicknames were good.
But one of the fisheries officers we work with over there, Ladina Pelicanos. We've nicknamed her the Tiger Shark.
Nice.
Because if you break the law, she's going to eat you.
Nice.
And one of the prosecutors from the Attorney General's office, Miss Kosha, we call her the Honey Badger. She's sweet, but the meanest animal in the world.
Uh-huh. All right.
And, she does. There's a customs officer there named Frisco McKay. He is the Bahamian equivalent of Hulk Hogan. He scares me, and I'm his friend. But we put all of these people together to work Operation Red Dawn.
Nice.
And basically how it started, there's a they're charter boats. What it is, it's a charter boat investigations. And so you have some charter boats from Florida that are going over to the Bahamas, and they're violating the law. Now, the Bahamas, like I said, is very protective of their natural resources, and so there's permits required to run a foreign charter in the Bahamas.
Okay.
Your vessel has to be inspected. You know, you obviously have to declare your passengers, and you have to pay taxes because you're generating, you know, a business income in the Bahamas.
Okay.
Well, as you know, there's always going to be somebody that's going to want to circumvent the law. And so there was one particular vessel. It was called Highly Migratory.
Isn't that – and this is a U.S. vessel.
U.S. vessel based out of South Florida.
What an apropos name, right?
Yes.
And you know, let me stop you for just a second. Mm-hmm. So listeners and watchers have a clear understanding of what you're talking about when you say charter. These are basically people who own – pretty long range. I mean, they're fishing boats, right? Like you might see somebody go out off the coast of Florida, sport fishing for marlin or some other kind of big game fish, but they're charging people in the U.S., U.S. citizens, to go all the way to the Bahamas and fish in Bahamian waters, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So that's what you can picture is if you want to go on a fishing trip and you go to Florida and you encounter some advertisement or somebody on the dock who's advertising that they'll take you out to the Bahamas to fish. And you, how much are they paying these guys to go fishing per day?
Yeah, they're $5,000 to $10,000 a day is
Whoa.
What they're charging for a charter fee.
So big money involved here.
Yes. And this directly competes against the legal businesses that get the permits.
Right. Okay.
And directly competes against the Bahamian businesses that are trying to operate legally.
So not only is it circumventing Bahamas' ability to kind of manage its own fishery, but it's damaging Bahamas' charter fishermen's business, right?
Yes, okay. And violating the laws over the bag limit violations, taking of unlawful species.
Gotcha. Okay.
And well, what brought this case to attention?
How did they, I was just going to say, how did they figure out this was a problem?
So the vessel was in the Bahamas fishing, and the vessel was approached by the Royal Bahamas Defense Force, which is the equivalent of the Coast Guard.
Okay.
And the captain, who was very arrogant, first refused to stop for the Defense Force. And so they trailed him for a while, eventually convinced him to stop. Now, again, you know, these are people that are slinging M16s. So what were you thinking?
Exactly. I was going to say you're going to get a shot across the bow pretty quick, right?
And so the vessel gets boarded, and the captain starts berating the Defense Force officer.
Okay.
And he films it. Films him giving this officer a hard time and posts it on Facebook. You know, here, I don't have to listen to the Bahamian authorities. I'll show them.
Right. Arrogance on display. So obviously,
yes. So he brings attention to himself. Mm-hmm. And so during one of our training sessions, this was brought up about this person that they suspected was violating the law. Well, if you look at how you enforce or how to, you know, effect an enforcement on a charter violation, I mean, there's certain elements you have to prove. You know, you got to prove that transfer of money. You got to prove that there was a hire, fishing for hire. Well, these vessels that are breaking the law, they coach their clients. And they say, hey, if we ever get stopped, we're just friends fishing. And so proving those cases can be very difficult.
Right.
And so this particular case was brought up. And so we, as a team in the Bahamas, we targeted this specific investigation. So when you start pulling the records, you know, when someone checks into the Bahamas, they go through immigration.
Right.
Well, this individual had been in the Bahamas 18 times in the last 3 years. So obviously it's a red flag. He's traveling over there quite a bit. And of course, license inspections, he had purchased no foreign charter license, no business licenses. Vessel's never been inspected for safety protocols, is all required, you know, by Bahamian laws. So we began an investigation. And so our role as, you know, as a consultant is, you know, to work with the local authorities to mentor them on how to do high-tech investigations.
Yeah, because you have no authority to do anything in the Bahamas. No. You're just an advisor, basically, yeah?
Correct. Yeah. And so we walk them through the steps on how you'll do, you know, a thorough involved investigation.
Right.
And so, of course, we know all the websites, all the social media sites in Florida. So we start doing searches on this and start producing evidence on Instagram, Facebook, of where this guy's posting pictures of all the fish that he's catching in the Bahamas. And of course you go to his website and he's openly advertising charter trips and he's unlicensed.
Right.
So, I mean, it wasn't a really hard decision of who to target. So we set up an investigation. We created a task force bringing in representatives from each of the agencies that would be involved, you know, fisheries, Defense Force, the Bahamian police and customs. And so we organized a task force putting it together, and we started working the investigation, started documenting evidence, walking them through how you would do an undercover investigation, you know, how to reach out online, how to collect evidence, how to preserve that evidence, and basically just walked and helped assisted with an investigation. And so a charter trip was ultimately booked with you know, some Bahamian officers. We coached them on undercover tactics, evidence collection.
Beautiful.
The tracking of the vessel, because you're going to have to prove it's in Bahamian waters.
Exactly.
And, you know, put this case together, and then they did a takedown. Like I said, Customs Officer McKay, yeah, just don't want to get in his way.
And now, unlike that first encounter where the charter boat captain was so arrogant, and you know the clients were also lying in on the lie. Now, the difference between that situation and this situation is Bahamian authorities know for a fact that they're lying, right? And
yes,
they can prove it. So it's a whole different ball game than them being kind of on their back heels, not able to prove or disprove what the crew and the paying clients are telling them about what they're doing or why, right?
And the customers were actually cautioned by the vessel captain on what to say if they were ever stopped.
Wow. Coached, really, huh?
Coached. Jeez. Absolutely. Coached about what to say if they were ever stopped.
Mm.
And what was just hilarious is when the takedown team came in to make the stop, the captain grabs, you know, the customers and tells them, remember, don't say anything about this being a charter because charters are illegal. And so just beautiful evidence to, you know, to prove a case.
Awesome. And yeah, so he's telling basically undercover officers, hey, don't forget the story. So you got it locked down that there's intent there. There's pre-planning. There's conspiracy going on. It's beautiful. Nice.
And this poor captain, again, grits for brains. So the Bahamas has specific laws. Mm. And you're a guest in their country. You should follow their laws. And so, of course, they have bag limits, size limits, license requirements, but they also have, gear requirements. So, for example, you can't use scuba gear to harvest any natural resources in the Bahamas. Yep, you can do free diving, but you can't use scuba gear.
Okay.
Bahamas is very serious about firearms. Now, in the United States, we love our guns. But the Bahamas has firearms restrictions, and you have to register any guns that you bring into the Bahamas. Now, I say that because poor Grits for Brains was carrying a concealed pistol when he stopped by the Bahamian authorities. And it's like, how? You just can't make this stuff up.
Unbelievable. And that's probably, that might be more serious than the fishing violation, right?
Yes, very so. Yeah. And, again, getting into the prohibited equipment, they don't allow scuba gear. Mm. They don't allow bang sticks.
Okay.
And so you start when the vessel was searched, of course, there's a bang stick on board. The captain's carrying a concealed gun. There's ammunition on board. And you had all these other violations that they were charged with.
Explain a bang stick to listeners who might not know what that is.
So a bang stick is a device that you use, scuba divers will use underwater. It's got a bullet on the end of the long pole. Whether it's a shotgun shell or whether it's a pistol shell, pistol cartridge. Mm-hmm. And you use it to shoot fish underwater. Mm-hmm. And so it's commonly used to shoot sharks. That's the most common use in the saltwater environment is shooting sharks with it. Well, sharks are protected in the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. And so, why do they have this illegal device on board to begin with? Kind of leads you to believe that they're violating other laws also.
You bet.
So they were arrested that day.
Nice.
You don't want to sit in a Bahamian jail, believe me.
As is true in many, many jails outside the United States.
It's not a resort.
It's not a resort. Exactly.
And of course, again, this is a different country, so the procedures are different. So these poor individuals, they sat in a Bahamian jail for a week.
Whoa.
Before first appearance.
Wow.
And so the case was really quickly solved. In the United States, a case like this would drag on for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Bahamas, it's over within 6 months. You're sentenced.
Interesting.
And so in this particular case, there was over $300,000 in fines.
Nice. That's huge.
Yes, huge, huge. Plus, there was a 3-year ban. These individuals now have a 3-year ban from fishing in the Bahamas.
Okay. That's also huge. So, that's going to cut into their business quite a bit.
Yeah. So the Bahamas takes the protection of their resources very serious.
Do they have forfeiture? Was there any risk they were going to lose their boat?
Well, the boat was seized.
Okay.
It was held for about 6 months. The forfeiture proceedings are still going on the vessel.
Okay.
But the Bahamian courts allowed them to place a bond. They had to place a $100,000 bond on the vessel in lieu of the forfeiture proceedings. And so that's still occurring. So there's an opportunity. They're going to lose the boat.
Wow. Okay. That's good.
Now this is a $500,000 vessel.
So by posting the bond, they're allowed to take the vessel. No, wait a minute. Let me back up a little bit. Did these guys end up going to jail in Bahamas other than spending their time in jail prior to their trial?
Oh, they spent a week in jail prior to the trial.
Okay.
Now, they were not sentenced to jail. They were sentenced to a fine.
Got it.
Now, if they don't pay the fine, there is a jail sentence associated with it.
Got it. Okay. And then they pay this bond on the boat so they can take the boat. But if the forfeiture procedures are successful in the Bahamian government seizes the vessel or forfeits it, they'll have to either return it or forfeit their bond. Is that the idea?
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
Gotcha. And this was a vessel called the Highly Migratory, right? Which yes. is kind of apropos. And how many times did they conclude that this vessel had been operating commercially, likely commercially, in Bahama waters?
Well, we know from just records that they were in the Bahamas over 18 times.
Yeah. Okay. So quite a few.
Yeah. And proving, proving those cases would be difficult.
Yeah. But likely, right? I mean, it's likely they were violating at that time, too.
Well, and remember, there's no statute of limitations.
Right, exactly. So whatever can be proved in the future is good to go. Mm-hmm. How many days do these trips last? So they where do they come out of, Miami or at least the ports on the East Coast there?
Yeah, they'll come off the coast of East Coast of Florida. They'll travel over the Bahamas. Depending on the client, how long he books a trip. Now, this particular trip was only one day.
Okay.
But the cost of the trip was $5,000.
Right. And typically, though, would you go and come back in a day, or would fishermen stay more than one day?
Depending on what the client wanted to do, if he wanted to book a three-day trip, it would be a three-day charter. Kind of funny, hilarious, the charter fee was paid at the end of the charter. On this particular fishing trip. And of course the money was seized back by the Bahamian authorities.
Nice. Okay, good.
So they didn't get their charter fee.
Nice. Okay. What happens to the clients that paid for this trip that were in the know and coached and agreed to be coached? What happened to them?
Well, these clients were Bahamian officers.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Were their cases made against any of the previous customers, or is that still a possibility?
It's still being pursued.
Okay.
Again, there's no statute of limitations. And so when you enter the Bahamas, you're going through immigration.
Mm.
And you fill out your passenger list. So, of course, the Bahamian officers now know all the passengers from the previous trips.
You bet, yeah.
And so, this case can go on for quite a while.
So on the one that where the undercovers were Bahamian officers, I thought maybe they were just a few of the, one or two of the officers were undercover among more than that number of clients. Like I thought maybe there might be five or six clients on the boat and two of them undercovers, but it's for that trip, it was booked by undercover people. Is that the
sure. idea? And think about that. Think about an undercover operation that we run in the U.S. You want to be able to tightly control all aspects of it.
Right.
And so this is, one of the training techniques that we taught them is to have absolute control. So you don't want any other civilians on board the boat.
Gotcha.
And so they paid the full charter fee in order to control, the operation.
Good. Yeah. It's funny. I was on I did some undercover work with NOAA on a fishing boat that was a little bit bigger than I think what we're talking about here, operating off the coast of California. And there were maybe 20 clients on the boat. So there were two undercover officers, me and another, on the boat. And it does create some real safety challenges because you're out there with 18 other people, right, who probably would not be too happy to know there were two undercover law enforcement officers in their midst. And everybody there's got a knife at a minimum, right, mm-hmm. if not some weapons. So, very good. If you can control for that, that was smart. Very good. So that case, Operation Red Dawn 1, only involved this one fishing vessel, the Highly Migratory. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. And so it was so successful, why not try another one?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And start deterring people, right?
So along comes Red Dawn 2.
Okay.
So again, another charter vessel, which complaints had been received by the Bahamian authorities. This first Red Dawn operation with Highly Migratory, it generated so much publicity that the complaint lines just started lighting up.
Excellent.
And so another complaint comes in on another vessel that's operating and doing the same thing. And so the team got back together again, put another operation together. And this was just in October. This is just last month. And so there was another arrest made. Now, that arrest is still pending. It hadn't been sentenced yet.
Right.
But just like the first one, it'll be over in 6 months.
And similar setup. Yeah, they're using doing some undercover work to figure out what's going on. The beauty about this is that, some people might say, Oh, well, the publicity is a bad thing, right? Because it's going to warn people. But that's kind of the job, or that's the goal, is to deter crime, prevent crime from happening in the first place. So yeah, while it's fun to be a law enforcement officer and catch lots of people, if you're not seeing the crime go down or disappear, that's kind of defeating the goal, right? So the publicity will be good, because now these charter boat captains operating out of the U.S., they're going to have to be, if they're planning to go do something illegal, they're going to have to be much, much, much more careful and wary and much more likely to do it, because they just don't know, right? Now that they know that Bahamas is paying attention, it's likely to deter future crime, right?
And that's the goal.
Yeah.
Compliance and the protection of the resource.
Exactly. It's not just to keep catching a lot of people. It's and that's where the publicity, there's a strategic point where the publicity becomes very important, because you want people to know that the crime fighters are out there, and be, you know, if you violate the law, you're going to come across a crime fighter and they're going to hold you accountable, right?
Right. And, you know, another operation that we're doing there, we taught an internet crimes class to some of the Bahamas officers.
Excellent.
And you showed them the tactics of working crime on the internet. They're having a blast.
Excellent.
So all of these people that are posting their fishing pictures from the Bahamas, you know, the bag limit on lobster in the Bahamas is 10. And you've got pictures of people with 150 lobster on their boat.
Perfect.
And again, I mean, they're just having a blast working these cases now.
Awesome. Are you taking a few lessons learned from Operation Wild Web?
Exactly.
Very good. All right. That's hot. It makes me very happy, George, to know that. That's very good. That makes me very happy. You know, so you mentioned lobsters. I think when we're talking about these fishing vessels, we're kind of, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, marlin for sure. Maybe sailfish, maybe sharks. What other species are being targeted? Lobsters, I assume. Yeah.
Yeah. Lobster, queen conch, wahoo. You've got a lot of pelagic species, you know, your marlin, your sailfish, you know, some really, really high dollar fishing species that are in the Bahamas that are targeted. Mm-hmm. And so they're very fortunate, very rich in natural resources.
And the whole lobster issue too is interesting, because there's a lobster fishery off California, and you know, the resource issue there is there's a temptation to take a lot of them, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like you said, if the limit in Bahamas is what, 10, and people are taking pictures of themselves with 100, that's a gross over limit, is how we would describe that in the mm-hmm. biz. And the issue with these larger fish, the pelagic species you mentioned, they're migratory, they move around. And so taking them out of certain ecosystems could harm breeding and feeding in other places of the world. So you might be impacting populations around the world. And of course, these are predatory fish, which puts them higher on the food chain, which means there's fewer of them. And so that's a real conservation issue for Bahamas. If you start taking too many of these larger predatory fish, it could have cascading impacts, right?
The Bahamas is only 50 miles off the coast of Florida.
Right.
And so what happens in the Bahamas affects Florida.
That is an excellent point, right? That's a really excellent point, because it's all the same waters in there. You know, thinking as a Fed, did you guys pursue this with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami? Because in my mind, I'm thinking Lacey Act violation, felony Lacey Act. If the clients in the U.S. are paying $5,000 and knowing that they're going to go over there and be expected to lie, that's a classic Lacey Act violation, a felony. Have you, or maybe you can't talk about that, but is the U.S. Attorney looped in there in Miami?
Yeah, let's not talk about that.
Okay. All right. Well, never mind. Maybe we should bleep that part out, George. Anyway, good. Another good thing for people to understand is even when if people in the U.S. leave the U.S. to commit crimes overseas, violate another country's law, and they pay U.S. dollars to go do that, whether it's fishing in the Bahamas or hunting in Africa or, you know, hunting in Australia or New Zealand, whatever, if they know in advance that they're booking basically some type of illegal activity and they're using U.S. dollars to pay for it, they're actually committing a crime in the United States under the Lacey Act. And it's that act of paying to go do something illegal overseas. And I think we're unique in the world in that regard, in that the United States takes a very strong interest in helping other countries protect their public safety, their environment, whatever it is. And yeah, an American citizen who travels in international commerce to commit a crime can very quickly find themselves in a U.S. jail as well as that dank, dark foreign jail, right?
Yeah, and think about that concept.
Yeah.
Because in some of these countries, the fines may be very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
But cost of doing business, it's part of my tourist trip.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start partnering, when the United States starts partnering with these other countries, and they're able to affect these charges back in the United States that are significant, that's what's going to stop the crime.
You bet. Yeah. Yeah. And it provides the foreign countries with some very valuable U.S. assistance, right? So like, for example, when I was in Africa, I can't tell you how many times I assisted foreign nations in their investigations of U.S. citizens who had come over to wherever, South Africa, Zambia, Zimbabwe, to illegally hunt some animal, whether it's an elephant or antelope or whatever. All of a sudden now, the thinly stretched Zambian wildlife authorities now have the assistance of a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service special agent in helping them make the case against a foreign national, which is difficult because a foreign national, you know, this boat's name is Haile Migratory. The problem is Haile Migratory can zip into Bahamian waters, fish, and zip out. And once it's out of Bahamian waters, there's not a lot they can do to check that unless they have cooperation from us. So pretty
exactly.
Cool. Very cool.
And you know from working internationally that these developing countries, they don't have a lot of money
mm-hmm.
to invest in their enforcement programs.
Right.
And so, you know, these are just tactics that we can use to help them in their enforcement.
Exactly.
Because as you know, many of the officers in these developing countries, many of these fisheries officers don't have guns.
Yeah.
Their agency can't afford it.
Right. Exactly.
And so they're out there patrolling and they're unarmed.
Yeah.
You know, many of these developing countries, they don't have patrol boats for the officers.
Mm-hmm. Or they don't, as we were talking about before we went live here, they don't have fuel. They might have the boat, but they don't have the fuel. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they have to calculate, do they have enough fuel to go out and come back?
Or do they have enough fuel to go out and then potentially get in a pursuit and track somebody down and then get back, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to have enough fuel on board to account for the unknowns you're going to encounter that day as well. Yeah. And we don't think about these issues in the States. You know, you and me, we're working for U.S. Fish and Wildlife or Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. You just fill up your boat when you need to go out. And it's not really a concern for you, you know? But some of these little things are very important, like bullets, fuel, maintenance. That might be a real issue for a foreign law enforcement officer. Let me tell you what I used to tell African officers and see if this resonates with you. I bet it will. I used to remind them, because a lot of times they would look to the U.S. and say, wow, you guys have some amazing toys, right? I mean, how do we get a drone, or how do we get night vision goggles, or how do we, you know? And I always used to remind them that you can have all the fancy tools in the world, but if you're not a good detective, they don't mean anything. And so I used to remind them, I was like, look, detectives have been catching people for hundreds of years, right? Mm-hmm. And formally, you know, since the first professional police forces, it's been about, 125 years-ish, you know, they've been catching people just by doing good old-fashioned detective work. And bring that to bear. Bring honest, hardcore, good old-fashioned detective work to bear on your problems. You know, you probably don't need night vision. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And that's what you're doing. What I love about what you're doing with the Bahamas is you're not coming in and saying, hey, here we are, a bunch of former command staff from different agencies in the States. We know what we're doing. Let us take over. You're coming in and basically you're backstopping them. You're empowering them. You know, you're basically saying, hey, here's some ideas of things we have done in the States successfully. What do you think? And it's up to them if they take it or not. And they're running with it. And then it's their thing, which is, that's the way to do it, man. That is really the way to do it.
Exactly.
Because you're working your way into obsolescence, which is right, right? Now Bahamas shouldn't need you too much in the future, right? Or they don't need you as much.
Well, and there's plenty of other areas in the world to work.
Exactly. You move on to the next place. That's why I love this this operation, these two operations. I think they're just great because it's going to empower Bahamas to do more and more in the future. Very cool.
Yeah.
We've really like blazed through this topic, George. What else you want to talk about on this?
Oh, wow. Well, I just finished up a trip in the Philippines, which was very, very interesting. So we were working some details there on dynamite fishing. Can you imagine it's still going on in the world, dynamite fishing?
Yeah. Yeah. And that may still happen in the Caribbean as well. I'm not sure. But are they, when you say dynamite fishing, are they targeting fish species or coral?
Well, they're targeting fish species.
I see.
But they're blowing everything up.
Right. Right. And these are fish species that end up in the food chain for us, or are they? Okay.
Yeah, food chain.
You mentioned to me, too, the other day that there's still some cyanide fishing going on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another illegal technique that's done throughout the Philippines and also in the Caribbean.
So explain how that works. How are they using cyanide to fish?
Well, they're injecting these poison chemicals into the water. Mm. It stuns the fish, and then they collect the fish and then take them to the market. Well, the fish have poison on them.
Yeah, exactly. And who knows what else they killed that they didn't collect, right? Mm-hmm. Put cyanide into the water. And that's just what's the purpose behind that? To just get as many fish as you can in as short a period as you can without much work?
Easier method to collect fish.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, you throw a stick of dynamite in the water and now you've got a couple hundred pounds of fish floating. Not to mention it blows up the coral reefs and nothing's going to live thereafter.
Right. Yeah, it is hard. You know, that stuff I remember hearing about 30 years ago when I was a much younger man, I thought that was a problem. And it's shocking to hear that it's still going on.
Yeah.
People might say, well, how are they not getting caught? But then you just go back to, if you're in the Philippines or Indonesia, you're talking about nations that basically are made up of thousands of islands. The Bahamas, it's made up of thousands of islands. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very daunting task to patrol that area and to not only find those people, but to promptly respond to those types of crimes in progress, right?
Right. And so think about it from our experience. From an investigative standpoint, how would you work blast fishing?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's more than just patrol techniques. There's investigative techniques. So the fishing villages where the blast fishermen are coming from. So if you identify who the fishermen are through intelligence, throw a GPS tracker on the boat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you can follow the fisherman. And then when he commits the violation, you've identified, you've apprehended your target. So we try to pursue this from an investigative standpoint. Go into the fishing villages at nighttime with swabs to detect explosives on the boats.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Run a bomb drug through the village.
Exactly. Yeah. Just go in there with a bomb detecting dog or check the boats, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. We just try to think outside the box in enforcement.
Mm-hmm. What do you run into? Like, say, let's talk about trackers for a second. You mentioned, it must be kind of daunting to keep track of what the foreign laws are. Because, of course, in the U.S., you'd have to have a search warrant to put a tracker on a vehicle or a moving vessel like that. Probably. I know you do on cars. Do you have to have a warrant to put it on a boat? I assume you do.
Well, I'm laughing because there's no Fourth Amendment in some of these other countries.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned that. That's what made me think of it. But at the same time, when you go in here to consult or to provide that backstopping, you kind of have to know, right? Or at least you have to consult them on what are your laws related to this, right?
How do you? Yeah, to kind of step back, when we go into a new country and we're working a new project area, and actually I'm doing a new project now in Sao Tome and Principe, Africa. But when we go into these countries, you know, we do an assessment. You know, so we look at their agency, we look at their law enforcement programs. Do they have equipment? Do they have personnel? And so we do an assessment. You know, we look at their laws and their policies. You know, are the laws enforceable? You know, do they have policies to address pursuits, use of force, you know, all the things that we take it for granted in our agencies, you know? So, you know, we do an assessment. What's their funding? You know, do they have adequate funding for their agencies, training programs, community involvement? So we'll put together an assessment, you know, based on our analysis, and then we make recommendations. And so these recommendations will include training programs. It'll include purchasing of equipment. And so, you know, we take this knowledge and we try to, you know, develop programs, you know, to build the capacity of these nations.
Right.
And a lot of it's investigative. You know, where we take it for advantage, you know, we've been doing investigations for years. Well, many of these other countries, I mean, they struggle with just going on patrol.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, we bring in, hey, you know, there's a better way. There's a less expensive way to do this and be more effective. Back to the GPS trackers. These countries don't have a lot of the hurdles that we have in the United States.
Right. Okay.
Now, granted, we created these hurdles. You know, the reason you got to have, you know, a court order for a GPS tracker is because of the abuses that were going on.
Exactly. Right.
You know, so we tried to, you know, consult with these countries. Don't make these mistakes because bad cases make bad case law.
That's right. Plus, of course, like you mentioned, we have the Fourth Amendment, which is kind of unique. Although some countries surprisingly have very strong laws protecting that type of right to privacy. Botswana, for example, very strong in that regard. So there are some countries out there that are a little more strict than us. There's countries, like, for instance, one of the things you and I were comfortable with in our careers was if we were interviewing a suspect, it's totally permissible in the United States to lie to the suspect, to tell them, to hint to them that we might know more than we do, or to say, you know, we have witnesses that put you at the location just to see how they'll react, right? And that's, but there are countries where that's completely illegal, where the law enforcement officers cannot lie to suspects they're interrogating or even just interviewing. So, you know, that's something to be cognizant of. What has been your experience working overseas with any corruption issues?
It happens. And you do see some corruption in some of these countries. That is one of our teaching topics is ethics. I mean, we're pushing ethics. You know, may take 20 years to fix it, but you got to start somewhere.
Excellent. Okay, good.
And so, yeah, there's instant. I'll tell you a little story. When I was in Africa, I'm on the way home. I've taught for the week. I'm on the way to the airport. And I had heard about some corrupt police officers. So it's kind of in the back of my mind, you know, that something like this may eventually happen, but I'm on the way to the airport. And I get pulled over by one of the local police officers. Now, I haven't done anything wrong.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of random police checkpoints throughout Africa. Every country in Africa. Yeah.
And so the officer doesn't speak English. He speaks French. I don't speak French. So we're translating on my phone. Google Translate.
Interesting. Okay.
So the officer tells me he's taking me to the police station. I owe $48,000.
Right.
And you know, I explained to him, no, I'm on the way to the airport. He says, well, you know how this works. You pay me on the scene. So I mean, we're doing all this through the translation app. And so I'm supposed to board a plane in 2 hours.
Right.
And so you know, I still have, you know, my law enforcement credentials. And so I pulled out my badge and said, Policia, Policia, Americana, Policia.
Nice.
Officer takes off running, leaves.
What? Really?
Now, it could have gone either way. I mean, he could have loaded me up and taken me to jail.
You bet.
Or I guess he chose that he needed to go extort somebody else.
That is a great story, and it's so typical of what happens when you encounter corrupt police officers in different countries around the world. And, you know, they're everywhere. We even have corruption in the U.S. here, too. Of course, what I always say is it's not – corruption's going to occur because you've got human beings in law enforcement positions, right? You know, the famous Jack Webb character from Dragnet back in the 60s said – he always said that the biggest problem with law enforcement is that law enforcement officers are human beings. And so you can't be that the issue is not, does corruption occur? The issue is, what do you do when you find it?
Yes.
And do you handle it? Do you make an example out of people? Do you hold them accountable? Or do you just say, well, that's how things are. And if you're in the latter, your country's going to go to hell in a handbasket pretty quick. If you deal with it, you can preserve your law and order in that country. What I always found, and see if you share this experience, but when I worked with foreign law enforcement officers in countries that might have a higher reputation for corruption, my philosophy was it takes too much energy to kind of suss out who's likely to be corrupt and who's not. Sometimes you know, sometimes you just aren't sure. So what I did was I gave them the benefit of the doubt. You're a police officer. I'm going to trust that you're going to do the right thing until you prove otherwise to me. And I'd give them that trust. And what I always found was even sometimes when I suspected an officer might be corrupt, I found that sometimes just working with me or working with another U.S. law enforcement officer, say from FBI or Homeland Security, in that particular case we were working on with them, they would not be corrupt because, God forbid, they did not want to get caught by the Americans being corrupt because it would be horribly shameful. And they want to work with Americans as peers. And so I found sometimes you might have an officer who's otherwise totally corrupt, but you can trust them on this case because they know you're watching.
Yeah, and you know, another great, great model that we like to use is identify those shining stars, those young officers,
right,
that will make a difference 10 years from now.
Right.
Because they'll be in command staff, and they're not going to tolerate these discrepancies and this corruption.
Exactly. And you can do that. You can build that kind of pride in their work. It sounds like you're doing exactly that in the Bahamas, which is great. You're identifying the superstars and helping them succeed. What do you think the future is for Bahamas on this issue in dealing with illegal transitory commercial fishing vessels coming in and out of their waters?
Yeah, they're going to be very effective at it. You know, they've got the tools now, they've got the techniques, they've got the experience. They're going to be very effective in curtailing this activity.
And it sounds like their judicial system's on top of it too, right? They understand the significance and the importance, and they're dishing out some fairly, fairly good penalties against people.
Oh, the judicial system, their leadership, yes, they're all on board.
Excellent. That's good. Sometimes, of course, countries, you know, the law enforcement understands the conservation issue or the importance, but the judiciary might not. So they hand out weaker sentences. Well, this is a great story, and it's unfolding. So, you know, listeners, watchers, if you Google Operation Red Dawn 1, 2, you can read the news stories about it, and you'll see this is still an operations that are ongoing, unfolding in the news as we speak. So there's probably more to come, certainly on Operation Red Dawn 2. George, fascinating. I'm so glad you came on to talk about this particular issue since it is in the news right now. It does involve Americans. It involves fish species that are important to Americans, important to Bahamians. And obviously, you know, we have territories in the Caribbean, so we have a very shared interest with the other nations in the Caribbean. So appreciate the work you're doing. It's amazing. Good job.
Oh, it's a blast. We're having fun doing it.
Really great. And I assume you'll continue working. You're working with WildAid, you mentioned, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you have other ongoing projects with them. So we'll be watching for other George Wilson news in the future. All right, my friend, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. We'll have you on again to talk about Operation Wild Web and many other things. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ed.
You bet. All right, everybody. Take care. We'll see you next time. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.